We now have Tina to come. We can just start from here. I have opportunities for question and answers, and I'll pass the microphone. When you ask the question, if you could also introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm Simin Royanian with Women for Peace and Justice in Iran. I just wanted to, after thanking the speakers, make one comment about one of the issues, because of course it's a long story. But when the first speaker talked about the peace movement allowing the Bush administration to have a higher moral ground, I believe they never had a high moral ground. As the second speaker spoke, already by 2003, the American government had put sanctions against the people of Iraq that the peace and justice movement in this country had been fighting against, and they had already been condemned as being the enemy of the people of Iraq, and because of they have propped up Saddam Hussein, and in fact given him the chemical weapons to kill the Kurdish people. The Bush government and American government, including Clinton, had no moral ground. So I don't think the peace and justice movement should be put on the defensive. I think that the peace and justice movement should turn the table on them, just like when at the beginning they said, you have to prove that you're a patriot. And we should always turn the table, condemn them for their crimes. We don't have to prove someone's innocence before we tell the American government, you do not have the right to bomb those people. Because we, irrespective of the government, that those people are under, and that government was propped up by American government, then, because they had a dictator, and we opposed bombing them, we shouldn't be on the defensive. I don't agree with that argument. The peace movement does not have to justify its existence, because it's for peace and justice.
I'm sorry if I didn't make my point clear. I don't think the peace movement has to justify its existence or has to refrain from going after the Bush administration or anyone else for acts of aggression. I need to suggest that. But I think both have to happen, right? In the run-up to the war in Iraq, we had delegations of people coming back and saying, oh, you know, the lovely Iraqi people, isn't that great? How could we attack this innocent country? Of course this was a war of aggression. Of course. We all, I'm sure, here fought against this war and must continue to do so. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that the Bush administration's claim to the high moral ground was justified. Of course it was hypocritical and deceptive and all the rest, right? And the same applies to the Clinton administration. I'm saying that ultimately an American movement against the intervention, an anti-imperialist movement, also has to address these other questions. It's not either or. We have to do both. Right? We have to address the fact that Iraqis were in an intolerable position, of course, partly as a responsibility of the United States, right? With the sanctions and the complicity in the Iraqi aggression against Iran, and there's a long history to this. But it's not okay to be silent, right, about the Iraqi regime, and I'm just expressing my opinion. We may disagree much, and I'll name names, right? Answer. Right, would not say a word in criticism of the Iraqi regime. And United for Peace and Justice, you know, was I think also unfortunately silent. And I think you need to have consistent standards, and you need to be able to talk about democracy and human rights everywhere when you're going after your own regime. And I think, and because sections of the American left and the American anti-war movement were not willing to do that, there's a price to be paid.
I'd like to begin by, I'm Jeffrey Kerber, Chief of the Teaching History Department at Howard University. First of all, I'd like to thank the two speakers for their work and their presentation. I have a couple of questions, but before I begin, I should share with you something I saw in the press yesterday. The Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, is rather embarrassed that the international terrorist appellation from the 1980s, which included the ANC, still has not taken Nelson Mandela off the international terrorist list. And why that's important is that he is still required to fill out extra visa papers to get into the United States. And she said, you know, we've got to address it. two questions. First of all, I'm pretty sure that there will be some other people who are going to try and get into this question that's been raised here. But with all due respect, I think there is a more important question than, you know, the anti-war movement and sort of who has the high moral ground. And that is, how do we explain the fact that prior to the invasion, the illegal invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, the anti-war movement was, comparatively speaking, far more powerful than in 1965-1966, right, the anti-Vietnam War, anti-war movement against Vietnam. And I remember being told this vividly by anti-war veterans in Vietnam in January of 2003. We were, you know, on a peace tour there. How do we explain the shift from that to the relative lack of politicization of the anti-war movement 5 years after, you know, this invasion? The second question is, what do you think the proclivities or tendencies are for US policy in the Middle East over the next 3 decades? And I really don't want you to talk about troop withdrawal, but what are the tendencies? I mean, what do you, you know, you laid out this some 6-decade long piece, but what do you think some of the possible scenarios are?
As far as the second question is concerned, I'm a historian, so I get to predict the past, right? That's one of our advantages. We're not political scientists. Somebody I was just talking to was saying this today. In the last decade or so in the Middle East, every time things have hit rock bottom, they tend to get worse, right? We've seen this in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the situation in Iraq, right, such that a fair number of Iraqis are missing the good old days of Saddam. Right, who they may have hated then, but their lives have gotten distinctly worse in the last couple of years. So I would not make any predictions. I would say that while I would like to believe that a democratic administration would be better, and in some respects it would, and there will be pressure, of course, to withdraw, as some of the Republican foreign policy establishment would, I think, favor as well. I don't see any very fundamental change policy in the basics of it. So I think there's a broad consensus in unfortunately in policy making circles and think tanks and in the media that this is a region the United States needs to continue to dominate, and it needs to do what it takes to make that happen, even if there's disagreement about specific means, about how far to go in any specific situation. So there people understand their cost to this. Right, there's a cost of letting the Israeli-Palestinian conflict continue as it is, but they seem willing to pay those costs, and they have other priorities. So I can't talk about long-term trajectories. Oil prices are likely to get higher rather than lower, right? That's a pretty safe bet, right? That means that Middle East oil will continue to be extremely important, perhaps more important. It'll continue to be instability because, right, there have been demonstrations, right, and strikes in Egypt in the last couple of weeks. And I was there a couple of weeks ago, and tensions are clearly rising because as in many parts of the world, people are having a hard time feeding themselves and their families, right? They're making $1 a day, they're making $2 or $3 a day, and rent prices are doubling. So there's going to be instability. These are, in most cases, autocratic societies. They're oppressive regimes, right? Whether they're propped up by the United States or not. And there will be demands for social justice and for change and for democracy. That means what is seen in Washington is instability that needs to be controlled. So the recipe is for further conflict, for further intervention at some level, unless we here can change the language and create a movement that can really make a difference here. As to why the anti-war movement has been depoliticized, I think that's what you're asking, right? I don't know, people may well have things to say. I suspect that part of it is that, in some ways, it's easier to run against the Democrats than it's easier when to make these kinds of arguments when they're in power. The presidential elections, the campaigns, the fact that leading Democratic candidates are criticizing the war in their own limited kind of fashion tends to demobilize much of a movement that's beyond the two major parties, right? And while what we definitely desperately need is as much pressure as possible on them. And on Congress, right, which was elected on a wave of anti-war support in 2006 and hasn't done a great deal, right? So unless there are people in the streets pushing on them, right, and threatening their re-election and holding their feet to the fire, their natural inclination is to do very little. But other people may well have takes on this. It's certainly a dramatic phenomenon. The war grinds on, and you know, there are a lot of people not paying much attention, right?
I can just add something else to what Zach had said about projections, American projections, and Harmer's projections. I can't predict the future, or I'm not going to talk about American elections because I think policy will not shift in major ways. But I think in terms of American foreign policy in the Middle East, I think there's the Washington speak at the moment is that you tolerate a level of instability as long as you don't have Hezbollah and another war of that level. But that instability continues because business goes as usual and fragmentation is better. Remember, stable society, when the heartland of the Middle East, the cultural and old center of the Middle East, which is the Persian Crescent, was stable, you had anti-American, a lot of anti-American countries. So I think it will tolerate that level of instability. The shift has gone to the Gulf. And so this is not because of oil also, but because of investments in capital and in terms of labor markets in the Gulf. So now there is a shift to the Gulf in America.
My name is Robert Schaefer. I'm from Shippensburg University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Corey, I appreciated your speech very much. I think that kind of analysis of why the sects and tribes become historically prominent at one point is very valuable. My question is on one particular point. You said that the issue is not simply withdrawal of American troops, but that the Americans have a responsibility to rebuild. And I think all of us would agree with that. The problem here is that that's part of what the Americans say they are doing. We must stay to rebuild. We cannot leave because we need to rebuild. How does this work? If the U.S. does withdraw, how is it going to rebuild? If the U.S. doesn't withdraw, there will not be peace and there will not be an ability to rebuild. So if you might just say, under what scenario could you imagine the U.S. Participating in a rebuilding of Iraq at this point?
This is a very difficult question to answer because the options that are given, you withdraw, there is complete American withdrawal, and this will not happen in the next, you know, in about, you know, a year or so. Even with the Democratic candidates, most of them say project at least 2 years in terms of withdrawal, versus five or forever on the Republican side. But it seems to me that once the American troops withdraw, there are international agencies that they can work with. And some of them, some NGOs, American NGOs, have begun working with these agencies. Only there needs to be more involvement of local organizations in Iraq. What we're seeing happening with NGOs, with non-governmental organizations who are international organizations, some of them funded by American money, is a very, very distorted work on issues of democratization and reconciliation building, because the issue of democracy becomes very important. Whereas for a large number of Iraqi refugees and Iraqis living there, the issue of democracy or reconciliation becomes tangential to the issue of survival and rebuilding these communities. One option is to put all of this under the roof of the United Nations. And it's not the United States only that owes the responsibility to America, to the Iraqis, but also the United Nations because of the 12 years of sanctions. And then with investments by American and British and other Europeans. But it needs to be an international effort with the consultation with community-based organizations within Iraq.
I'm Ira Sherness, University of Colorado, and I'd like to just follow up
by asking, excuse me, the popular image we have now, of course, is from our mainstream media, is that the Iraqis are not capable of doing that because they are so divided along religious and tribal lines that they're not capable of working together, so that even if the United Nations took control, even if a lot of funds were poured in, that still the whole thing is going to dissolve into chaos. You've heard that argument over and over. And I wonder how you assess the actual potential for that kind of process, the kind of process you were just describing, to actually happen given the existing political tensions and religious tensions. To what extent can they be healed, and what way might that happen? And for some of us who have difficulty hearing, can I ask you to hold the mic up real close?
Okay. I think the religion, the sectarian lines that divide the lines of division of Iraq between Iraqis, are going to be something that the United Nations and other international organizations have to deal with. In each area of Iraq right now, even areas controlled by militias, these militias run social services. I think until these militias are, there needs to be some sort of security where there's the demilitarization of the militias, but they will continue having some arms. The thing is not to wait until we have a central government that's a strong government and you work with it. Work on local level with these organizations that have been set up by militias, and not all of them are sectarian. A lot of them work within religious institutions in these regions, in, for example, Najaf and Karbala, in Sadr City, as well as in other areas in Anbar province. So I think the United Nations cannot go in there, the international community cannot go in trying to invent the wheel and reshape Iraq society. Iraqis are sick and tired of building or creating new Iraq. I mean, they tried, this has been tried with the Ba'ath, it's been tried by the Americans. What they want right now is, this is the situation on the ground. Even if we need to work with militias, I have to apologize, I forgot to put on my, even working with these communities, with these militias, as they exist, is one way of doing this within Iraq itself. Outside Iraq, there are community-based organizations within these countries that are working with Jordanians and, for example, and Iraqis. Some of them are American organizations, and they're working with community organizations, sports clubs, for example, schools, computer learning centers. So the idea is not to change, but work with what exists.
We have time for about two more questions.
I'm Ross Kurzau from Washington. I do work closely with an anti-war, Iranian-American anti-war organization, but I speak for myself here, so my organization will remain unnamed for right now. Very much reject the notion that the anti-war movement, the segments of an anti-war movement in the West that remained to their true anti-colonial mission need to apologize. As a person of Middle Eastern origin, I very much feel that we who struggle for people's rights in the Middle East, we don't need the sympathy and help of Western NGOs and so on. In my country of origin, in Iran, we had a revolution that was carried out without international help against the country that was one of the mightiest US-backed repressive military dictatorships in the world, and we succeeded without Western help. Iraqis, likewise, if they wanted to get rid of the government of Saddam Hussein, they could have done so, organized. If they wanted it badly enough, they could have done it without help from the West. And lastly, I want to say that in relation to that, that because taking that approach of let's condemn both U.S. interventionism and the government like Saddam Hussein, because that actually helps interventionist forces, it is very dangerous to imply that there is some kind of symmetry here. there would only be symmetry in these situations if, for example, Iran or Iraq also had a couple hundred thousand troops outside U.S. borders in Canada or Mexico, or if they had huge naval armadas off the coast of the United States. The situation is not comparable at all. So to condemn both this and that, to me, is a wrong-headed approach.
I don't believe I used the word symmetry, but let me put it a little differently. I think it's important for the peace movement, anti-imperialist forces in the United States to have a positive program and not simply a negative program. It's not enough to say, don't invade, bring the troops home. We need a larger vision of the world. It's partly, I think, our internationalist responsibility. I'm not suggesting that the United States as a global empire and Saddam's Iraq are equivalent or the same. I do think that to win over and educate a wider segment of people in this country, it's useful to talk in broader terms, right? Dina knows, I'm sure I know, many Iraqi exiles who supported in 2003 the invasion of Iraq, right? Now, I disagree with them. I think they were wrong. I suspect that many of them may have come to the conclusion that they were wrong to have that position, right? But it's also possible to understand it at that moment, given their despair in living under that regime. And they seem to have felt, rightly or wrongly, that they couldn't get rid of that regime by their own efforts, right? I'm not saying they were right in that kind of position. And again, we're not saying that by any stretch of the imagination, the US invasion of Iraq was justified. So we may disagree about this, and that's fine. Let's leave it at that.
My name is Max Obama, and I work with Wartime's Camp Bucaguerra's anti-war project. First, I want to say something about the anti-war movement. Jeff posed the issue about the relative politicization of the current anti-war movement and the anti-Vietnam War movement, and that's a very long and complicated discussion, but I think the fundamental thing is that the anti-Vietnam War movement came on the heels of the civil rights movement and was in the midst of the worldwide upsurge of left-led national liberation movements all around the world. And it came off a period of advance and victory and optimism in the international left at a high point. And this war comes after 30 years of neoliberalism rollback, which did tremendous damage to the core constituencies, the African-American community in particular, which drove progressive struggles in the 1960s in the United States and the left. So while the outpouring of anti-war sentiment with being the second superpower, you know, at the February 15th worldwide demonstrations here was an indication of the tremendous potential of anti-war activity in the United States, it was deceptive because it was not politically deep. It was based upon the fear of an immediate cost to the United States of the immediate consequences of an invasion. And when that collapsed, in the mission accomplished moment, that rug went out from under that, and the more underlying historical context of the difference between 1965 and 2008 came to the fore. And that's what we've been battling in the last number of years. Now, I share the agony of everyone else in this room about the fact that we're not further along, but I think, especially the historians, putting it in that context of what the time period is and where we were in 9/11 versus where we were in 1965 is extremely important. And then my question that was on a different topic, which is, it seems to me you have the quagmire or defeat of the U.S. the neoconservative project, which was eloquently laid out by the speakers, has led to a division in the ruling elite where there is a faction represented by Baker Hamilton in its different versions, which says we need to retrench. We need to step back and retrench and cut some losses in order to ensure U.S. hegemony in the Middle East. And there are different versions of Baker Hamilton, from Murtha, who's all the way on the left wing, who says we should completely get out of Iraq and go over the horizon, over to Hillary Clinton, more on the right wing of that, which, you know, leave the maximum number of troops. But my question is this: if that faction gains control and begins a retrenchment retreat process, how stable is that? Because it doesn't seem to me that this occupation is all that stable right now. And if they begin a process of retreat and retrenchment, what are your estimates of what their options will be? Re-escalation, being driven back further? I mean, it seems to me that opens up a tremendous can of worms for them, as well as for us. So, even though you don't have a crystal ball, yes, what's going to happen?
I mean, there are two arguments about this that you hear among the Iraqis I've talked to, right? One option says if they withdraw, there will be no central state. Then, as it is, it doesn't exist anymore. If the Americans withdraw, there will be no state whatsoever, and there will be a total disintegration of Iraq. But the argument itself is problematic, because those who control the central state in Iraq have an invested interest in dividing up Iraq. I mean, those factions. Will there be more killing? There's no doubt there will be an escalation, maybe in violence. But for a large number of Iraqis, at this point, there's no direction whatsoever. So what can happen? It will be divided, it will be fought out. So there will be, in terms of loss of human lives and further destruction. But I think what will emerge are these cantons controlled by military warlords. Until these warlords decide to come to grips and decide that it is more profitable for them to reach political accommodation, this will continue. These divisions will continue. I think the United States withdrawal in the short run might escalate the violence, but in the long run, the Iraqis have to do this for themselves. With the clear understanding there is a responsibility on the part of the United States government, whoever it is, to pay and to take care of, to help reconstruct Iraq some way.
Yeah, I think I agree with your analysis. I think it makes a lot of sense, and certainly the Baker Hamilton. And Senator Obama says a similar thing, right? An offshore presence, right? Which is sort of going back to the old days, not that long ago, right? The 5th Fleet, the 7th Fleet, they're still there. Still intervene, but you do it from a little further away, right? So it's an extremely unstable situation. They've opened up a can of worms. The United States has relatively little control about what goes on the ground. They can arm one militia, but tomorrow that militia may turn against the U.S. forces. And how this plays out, no one can predict. The betting of the Baker Hamilton types is that this will be less destabilizing in the long run. You get the troops basically out of there quicker, sooner, whatever the timetable might be, and that reduces the risk of larger collapses, right, of instability spreading. They may or may not be right. I don't think they have any great grip on it either, except that they understand that this project is finished and something needs to happen, and that the direct military intervention is no longer viable, even in terms of the larger project of maintaining imperial control. But where it goes from here, and whether they're right in their scenario, I guess we'll find out probably.
Professor Cooney, thank you so much.